Right. So this is yet another class in the Fundamental Teachings series. And this will be a class on emptiness. Could somebody pass out chant books, including one to me? And is the speaker up high enough? Can you hear? Cool. All right. And then those of you at home, if you have a chant book, you're going to be looking at the Heart Sutra, which is on page 22. And if you don't have a chant book, the link has been placed in the Zoom chat to the PDF version of the chant book. And then I believe it's also would be page 22. So, just as a bit of reflection beforehand, so in this class series, I started off with like anicca and anatta as teachings, impermanence and not self. And then we went to dukkha and the Four Noble Truths. And then we went to the Eightfold Path. So this is the fourth class, I think. Anyway, and after presenting the teachings, like the Eightfold Path, I think was very interesting. But after presenting the teachings on anicca, anatta, dukkha, and the Four Noble Truths, I left class feeling kind of unsatisfied. Like, I don't know, like it didn't, I didn't feel, I mean, and you may have had a totally different impression, right? And it's kind of difficult to tell when you give a talk or a class. I didn't feel like I was able to really get people to connect with the teachings the way that I usually am able to. And like, I don't know, it felt like it had a tendency to go toward the intellectual and didn't seem directly relevant. And I was reflecting on this, and then I realized it kind of that those teachings, which I've always really appreciated, are almost like kind of from a different form of Buddhism. Like they're really not, it's not that they're not Zen teachings in that they're incompatible, it's just that we don't tend to use them or talk about them. We don't tend to phrase things that way. So it got me thinking about, well, how do we phrase those things in Zen? Right? Like surely those teachings about essentially that we are the source of most of our own suffering, the not self and impermanence and all that. So I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but I think the next time that I share those teachings that I might, kind of mention, all right, here's how what the Buddha originally said, and then kind of like I did for the Eightfold Path, I'll say, well, this is how we approach it in Zen. And the gist of it is that just like we were reciting tonight in let's see, it was Keizan, Zazen Yujinki. Anyway, it was talking about like we do it through Zazen. We do it through our direct experience in Zazen, observing the self. So we study the self, and in studying the self, begin to realize aspects of the self which are impermanent and ungraspable, and therefore leading to our perception of emptiness. So anyway, I don't know if that was helpful or just added to confusion, but moving on to emptiness, I figured we would just read through the Heart Sutra. I would just stop and comment, and people can just chime in with questions and what have you. So, let me start off by saying, which many of you would have heard me say before, that emptiness is a translation of the word shunyata, which I think is the Pali or Sanskrit term. And then I'm sure there was a Chinese term. And it really does, if you look at the possible translations, emptiness is pretty much it. But we're not talking about things being empty of meaning, which is kind of the baggage that that term has for us in English, right? Oh, it's empty, would mean empty of meaning or merit or value or something like that. So it's definitely not that. It's empty of a specific thing. So just like you don't say something's empty unless it's something that you might expect to have contents, right? Like a house can be empty if it doesn't have any people in it or furniture in it. A glass is empty if it doesn't have any liquid in it, right? You don't say a rock is empty unless a rock has a hollow out inside and you might expect something to be in it, right? So when we say empty, we're saying something that we expect to be there is not there. So it's looking very specifically at this sense of an inherently existing, independent, enduring, another word that I've heard is autonomous self-nature that we presume, especially we have other people as well. We can project it on other things and beings, but primarily we do it with ourselves, with people close to us. We imagine that we have this enduring self-nature. So let's see. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, this is one of the main Mahayana sutras, right? This little sutra here.
Page 22.
Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva is the bodhisattva of compassion. So I always think it's very interesting that who is waking up to emptiness? It's the bodhisattva of compassion who is waking up to emptiness. So it gives it kind of a warmth from the beginning that you might not expect that it would have. So when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita is the perfection of wisdom. Prajna's wisdom, paramita is perfection. And the perfection of wisdom is specifically like insight into emptiness. So it's not just any wisdom. It's not just being wise about all kinds of things. It's specifically this insight. So the Bodhisattva saw all five aggregates are empty. The five aggregates, which we're going to go through here, form, sensation, perception, mental formations and consciousness. So this is like this is the aspects of a human being. Just like a chair has like a seat and legs and all these parts, we have all these are the parts of which we are made. And it's meant to be an exhaustive list, like anything we can think of as being part of our experience or ourself or our body or anything is included in this list. So Avalokiteshvara saw all those five aggregates are empty of this inherent self nature and thus relieved all suffering. So once again, these teachings are not about metaphysical speculation. They're not about philosophy. They're about gaining insight into reality because it relieves suffering. It liberates and frees us, as it says later, frees us from fear. So this is something we want to wake up to, not because, I don't know, not because we just should, or it's fascinating, or something like that, but because it can relieve our suffering. So then Avalokiteshvara Bara explains to Shariputra, who's one of the Buddha's disciples. Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself, form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. So, form is our body. And so, going through this teaching with reference to the body, and then but the same is also true of sensations and perceptions and mental formations and consciousness, all the other aspects of ourself. And this teaching, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. So it is very, very difficult, if not impossible, to grasp emptiness. You know, we think it's like a fact or a truth or something that we can acquire at some point, right? That if we sit and meditate or something, we'll be like, you know, now I get that piece of info that I've been waiting for, waiting to understand. But it's not really like that. It's like when we think of like, I am empty of inherent self nature. Where we get stuck, where I get stuck, is I think I am empty. There is I, and but I unfortunately have lack this inherent self nature, which I kind of would like to think I had. But emptiness is not, it's not something possessed by manifestations. Let's put it this way. If there was not a thing, there would be no emptiness. Like, you can only speak of the emptiness because there is something to be empty. So it's not like emptiness exists over there as a truth, and it, you know, and the forms over here are burdened by that somehow. It's like this is a truth, a reality of all manifestation. It has this quality of emptiness. And so it's not separable from the form itself. It's not something that detracts from the value of the form or the sensations or perceptions or formations. I guess, yeah, well, it's not like I'm going to explain it to great satisfaction before we move on. So, but feel free, if anybody, just go ahead and like raise your hand if there's something else that you want to point out. So Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So dharmas are things. Yeah. Dharmas with a little d are things. So what would we mean to say that a dharma does not arise or cease, neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease? So we just talked about impermanence. Like, everything is impermanent. So what would it mean to say, I wanted to bring some identifiable object up here, but let's say, okay, this bell, right? So what do we mean that this bell neither increases, you know, arises nor ceases? It's neither defiled nor pure, neither increases nor decreases. I guess the way that explanations are insufficient, Let me put it. So here is this metal pounded into a shape, which we call a bell. And it has a function as a bell because, because of its shape and how we treat it right now. I think most people would accept that there is no inherent bell essence within this, that if we melted it down, we would not cry like, where did the bell go? Like we don't tend to impute that on objects the way that we do on living beings. But still, we can think of this as like this bell came into existence. This, even there, we start to kind of create a bell. There is like this bell came into existence. This bell is going to pass out of existence. But the bell only exists right here. All of our labels about self and other, alive and dead, sentient, insentient, good, bad, up, down. These are labels that we put on reality. They don't have any graspable, lasting reality to them. They're conventions. So there is no bell that came into existence and is going to pass out of existence someday. There's just the unfolding of conditions. Right now, we call that a bell because of the way we use it. All explanations are very unsatisfying. So therefore, given emptiness, there is no form. No sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. No sight, no sound, smell, taste, touch, or object of mind. No realm of sight, do not down to no realm of mind consciousness. So these are the in the ancient Indian lists, right? This is describing all of our aspects of experience. So we have the five different senses. We have the contact with what we see or smell or taste or consciousness of it. And so that doesn't really exist. Not the way that we think it does, right? Our ideas about it reify these things and that it doesn't reflect reality. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, down to neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death. No suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. So these are referring very specifically to Buddhist teachings. Neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance was the 12-fold chain of dependent origination that I spared you. But no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path. That's the Four Noble Truths. No knowledge and no attainment. Eightfold Path, the whole point of practice. Saying even these things do not inherently exist. So, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita. So, relies on this emptiness. And thus, the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana, realizes the ultimate kind of liberation from suffering and desire and the realm of karma. So with the mind is without hindrance. In my own personal experience, I experienced some of this with like early on in practice. I still, or not even early, so early on in practice, but the habit of having built up, for a couple decades before I got to practice was being very, very sensitive to criticism. And I wouldn't show you I was sensitive to criticism. You know, I did the blustery thing, like, nah. But then I would go home and be really mortified, right? So, you know, if somebody said, oh, don't you know that talk you gave was, I don't know, I was a little, you seemed a little arrogant about what your understanding is or something like that, right? And I might go, But then I'd go home and I would just be like, I suck. I know I suck. I'm a miserable person. I know that, you know, like just, you know, struggling with that. So this is where like we actually get insight into these teachings, not by, you know, sitting and deep in meditation. Oh, you know, we have some transcendent view. Maybe occasionally might have something like that. But a lot of times it's more a matter of at some point recognizing like there is no fixed me who needs to take on any criticism or actually, you know, congratulate myself and give myself credit. Right? This is like, I mean, I'm alive. I have responsibility for navigating my life and taking care of my karma. But as long as I'm doing the best that I can, this is all just an unfolding. There is no inherent me to be defiled, to be yeah. So therefore, some hindrance fell away, right? So really actually fell away, not just, you know, some kind of theoretical thing, but a sense of, you know, if you criticize me, it's like, that's very interesting. I'm sorry that my actions had that effect. Like it, I'm not, I just don't take it on. There's just let it just wash on through. So I don't know. I feel like that is a, you know, part of just an example of kind of tasting emptiness within one's own direct experience. So all Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on Prajnaparamita, on this teaching, and thereby attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the Prajnaparamita as the great miraculous mantra. So a mantra is a chant, like, I mean, not that I don't really believe in this. Some people do, whatever, you can be agnostic about it if you like, but a mantra is a chant that has some power to it. So, you know, saying a chant in a particular way might maybe protect you from harm, or you know, ask for the blessings of the Bodhisattva of compassion or something like that. So the idea is that actually, like chanting this sutra is like a mantra, but also that applying the what I like to think is like the medicine of emptiness is like a mantra that can help give you, I don't know, whatever you need in the given moment. The great bright mantra, the supreme mantra, the incomparable mantra, which removes all suffering and is true, not false. Therefore, we proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra, the mantra that says, so the whole sutra is like a mantra, but then this is like a little extra mantra that embedded within. Gate gate para gate para sangate bodhisvaha, which essentially means kind of like beyond, going far, going beyond, always going beyond, and bodhisvaha is kind of like Yahoo. Maybe that's just like, I don't know, too overwhelming, but you know, I guess just you guys have heard about emptiness before, and what, you know, what kind of things have you been confused about, or
All of it.
Yoli says all of it. Jen.
Oh,
Yeah, I guess, because I can hear you better, I think.
so I guess I just want to ask because I sometimes experience like a feeling of like sometimes you talk about boundaries dropping away and the feeling that just, oh, and knowing the physics of it, that I'm made of these molecules and everything around me is made of these molecules and they all just like form the whole universe. And I guess that's kind of how I've been thinking of emptiness is just we're just this temporary form. But hopefully, I guess the part I want to ask is I want it sounded like the energy that's in all of the forms remains. And is that a thing that I'm making up for?
Well, and you reminded me too, there's other translations of the Heart Sutra, and most of the time it's emptiness, but Kaz Ta-Nehisi uses the word boundlessness instead of emptiness. And I like Jinri and I feel like we both kind of came up with boundarylessness is even feels even more to the point. So recently I've been conceiving of like these different main teachings, which we're going to be going through now, right? Of like emptiness, suchness, Buddha nature. Like they're not all the same thing. Of course, they're all empty terms, right? But they don't all refer to the same thing. They're highlighting something different, but like it's all one reality with a capital R. And these different things are pointing out different aspects of it, like different paintings of a sunset, right? So one highlights the light, and one highlights the, I don't know, the waves, and one highlights the shapes, and maybe a poem highlights how the sunset made people feel or something like that, right? So emptiness, I mean, I do like the word emptiness because it is pointing toward this like absence of what we thought was there. And when we really have, I mean, we our insights into this, it's not an all or nothing thing, right? It's not like, one day I understood it, it's complete, I nothing more to see there, right? It's the, our insights can deepen, but when we like really awaken to this for the first time in a very visceral, personal way, it can be quite a shock. I mean, it's like, shit, really? Like, just like that thing that I thought was there. It's not really, it's not there. Like, it can be quite disorienting. But then we go on to, well, then what, right? That's not the only aspect of reality. It's not the only aspect of the sunset. So then there's kind of suchness is kind of that what we're going to talk about next week. And I'm sure you'll come away with a complete understanding of that. Is like, well, this is how things, once we could kind of perceive their emptiness, then we recognize like, I don't know, everything's amazing. Everything is just like buzzing with life. Even things that aren't alive, technically alive, are just like, wow, they just exist luminously. And they appear that way because we're not laying our conceptual framework over them. And perceiving them in that limited way. So I think it's probably related a little to what you said of just that. Yeah, like I mean, because to some extent it's like, well, if everything's empty, then isn't it just a nihilistic void? It's like, no, like the only thing that drops away when we see emptiness is our own conceptual overlay of everything. That's the only thing that's missing. Like, life doesn't need our conceptual overlay. Yeah, it has some functions in our daily life, but that's how things appear when we're not seeing everything through that strict mental filter. Leah and then Natalie.
What about me?
I don't know. Did you have your hand up there too?
I stood up.
Okay. All right. Leah, then Natalie, then Jinryu.
Okay. Now I'm like, Jinryu. Oh. So I have so many questions. I've been like writing notes on this thing for so long, like before this meeting. But anyway, I'll just start with one question. Okay. So this particular part, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So I've always had kind of trouble wrapping my brain around that one, but is what that part getting at is that the only real thing is the present moment? 'Cause it seems to be time-based. Like a couple of these are like they neither arise nor cease, neither increase nor decrease. For example, because you said, because the bell is here now, what it is. But that seems to me to be like a present, like an in time thing. Am I getting
I mean, because we want to, and I mean, I find my mind getting pulled down like intellectual, philosophical, like rabbit holes, just as easily as anybody. We're like, oh no, is it true? I don't know. What does this have to do with time? But we don't want to say, like, this has to do like this moment, and outside of this moment, then things do arise and cease, right? As if there's like two separate realities. But what we could say is that, what I often call like the independent dimension of reality, which is right here, right now, ungraspable, things as it is. This is the only thing that's real. And as soon as we start to think about arise, increase, decrease, as soon as we start to compare things, as soon as we start to discriminate in any way, we're departing from just this, which is like, that's okay. That's a dimension of life. But that's all of that is to some degree an abstraction. As soon as we start to think about the bell existing and non-existing, now we're just kind of telling a story.
Okay, things as it is, beyond discriminating mind. Okay, got it. It's perfect. I totally understand.
Okay, glad you could clear that
So, when we're talking, you said that instead of using the word emptiness, you could say boundlessness or boundarylessness. I was curious more about that. Emptiness to me is a hard term. It's to me, it does sound nihilistic somewhat. There's nothing there. So I'm curious why we don't use boundaryless. Yeah, it sounds like we're just here and we're all expansive and we're not confined to this body. We are everywhere. It sounds positive.
It's true, but then we say we are everywhere.
Okay.
Then it's very easy for us to think, I am boundless.
But
Like,
aren't
and
we
then we're
all?
still, but then there's
Aren't
still, we could still retain a sense of I.
What if it's a we?
I, even we, there's no one who is boundless. In the boundlessness, there's no divisions.
It mean that everybody, everything, every object, if each one is boundless and I might be different than everyone else here. I think of in turn, I believe in spirit in everything though. In I do believe in inanimate object too, has there's a certain spirit to it. I believe that. So I feel like, but it's not confined to that object or
my sphere is not confined to me. And to me, that makes sense of that boundlessness, if it expands infinitely within each being, within each plant, within each object, and it's all forming one. And then in this human realm, through our human mind and human lens, we can't see that so much usually, and it's confined, but it's all expanse. All of us and everything is all expansive.
And I think
Is that a
that,
way to look at it through this?
I
Or
mean, I think any way we look at it ends up having its own limitations. But I think what you're speaking to is a real, like, experiential, at least periodically, right? Experiential sense of that boundlessness, which, my example is like, on occasion there I'm sitting zazen. And a bird calls. And if I'm very still, it's like that bird is me, like that, but not that bird is separate and I'm over here and we're actually one. Like, it's just what is me? I'm perceiving a sound that bird made it, like that bird's inside my head now. Like, what? There is no. There's no clear line between, what is when we breathe in air and exchange molecules, and like we're actually like permeable, and another word for it is interdependent with all things. Like, we are only who we are because everything else is the way it is.
So Suzuki Roshi has a Tathagata teaching about the bird.
Maybe you can come up and tell us after Jinryu and then Denny.
Yeah.
How do you
I
think?
guess I just struggle with the word emptiness versus I like the boundaryless or more so. It seems to fit
Yeah.
more for me. So maybe I switch them out.
Yeah,
I
yeah. I would say, I mean, if Kaz Tanahashi does it, I guess, it's totally legit.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I mean, here's what I can contribute. I don't know if it would be helpful or not. There are three books that I am aware of on the Heart Sutra. Red Pine is excellent. Thich Nhat Hanh, excellent. Kaz Ta-Nehisi is also good, but he's really stuck. His whole purpose to me is, did it start in Pali or did it start in Chinese? Was it written in China? Was it written in India? I think a Chinese man went over to India and wrote it in Pali and then came back. And so that's what that's all about. And it's very interesting. But he did come up with boundaryless. The thing I got from Red Pine is that, and what I am gathering is, and I don't know if this is true, but Shariputra is often used as a foil in a lot of these stories to point at what the story wants to point at. And Shariputra, the Heart Sutra came into being several centuries after the Buddha. Probably 500. And so there were Buddhist sects who began to deviate from what the Buddha taught and started to say, well, all this not self stuff, he didn't really mean that. We do have something, it lasts. And Shariputra was in that frame of thought.
I don't
Savastivada.
know. Oh,
And Avalokiteshvara is saying, don't go doing that. What the Buddha said is really true. Form and emptiness are not different, they are the same. And I agree with everybody who struggles with emptiness. I wish the originator of the first English translation coming to the West had not used that word. But when I hear it now, I just have to translate it in my head to what is more useful to me. And so I do look upon the Heart Sutra. You know, we look at the Heart Sutra and we get into these discussions of form and emptiness. What does emptiness mean? But the Heart Sutra is really saying, this is what reality is all about. And I could go further with that, but I won't. But I did want to come back to the very beginning, if I may, and just, you know, the discussion last week about the Eightfold Path and your 10 fields of practice. You know, we spend 3 months. December is kind of Rohatsu, Christmas vacation, holiday vacation, excuse me. So we got 11 months, three of them we spend on the precepts. So we study the precepts a lot. We have Heart Sutra, either in English or Sino-Japanese, every service. And then we have the things that we recite in the service. That is where our heads, that is where my head is. And so when we introduce the Eightfold Path, I don't ever think about it that much. I mean, it is clearly a bona fide teaching of the Buddha, but as it relates to what we study, perhaps in Soto Zen or perhaps specifically here, we're not necessarily studying that. And so I think it has to do with where our focus is, not with our understanding of that. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's all I wanted to say.
I'm just still going to stick with emptiness.
You're what?
I got to stick with emptiness. It points at something that each of us ideally will personally awaken to. And it's really about, I mean, I spent a whole practice period at Tassajara led by Reb Anderson. And it was a very fascinating, those 3 months, three retreats, most of it was like silent anyway. And he was leading us through some teachings and asking us to look for our view of an inherently existing self. Not look for emptiness, but look for the view of the inherently existing self. Just a very fascinating way to approach it. Because, you know, it arises, you know, a million times every day. And it's just, every time we're inclined to break a precept, every sense of irritation, every sense of inadequacy, every arising of dukkha is like, is that? Even once we have some experience and insight into the emptiness of that phenomena, we still, you know, it still arises. It's something that's kind of wired within us to have this sense of ourselves. So, yeah. Denny.
Wow, now I wish I hadn't raised my hand. I did have not too long ago an experience where this kind of conceptual understanding of what I thought emptiness was kind of came together for me. And it started out with what you just described Domio, and that was realizing that in my zazen, every now and then I would arrive at a point in which I felt myself really separating from my thoughts. I was just I was just observing them. It wasn't like I was connecting to them and feeling the emotions, but I just knew they were there, but I wasn't attached to them. And then I read or started reading Thich Nhat Hanh's translation of the Heart Sutra, and which Jinryu just mentioned. And he made the point that he thought that emptiness was an incorrect translation, and that what the way he liked to think of it was as dependent arising, which is what I had heard about and had some understanding about, but didn't really connect with the concept of emptiness. And it made all the difference for me, because it's like, this is in my head anyway, nothing really exists except in relationship to something else. It's like that cup that you just had. If you put that cup alone in a room and nobody observed it, it would just be a hunk of metal. And in dependent arising, everything is rising because of causes and conditions. And it's just all happening all the time. And everything, one thing is influencing everything else, and nothing exists except insofar as everything else is interacting with it. And therefore, nothing is permanent. And then the point that was made by Jen, where there are no boundaries, that's kind of like form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Like I kind of see that energy that she was talking about as the potential in emptiness. You know, form comes out of emptiness, and then it, because it's empty, it returns. It just becomes energy, or Buddha nature, which is the foundation of all of it. And I hope some of this makes sense, but it all kind of came together for me. And it'll probably collapse, I don't know, at some point. But then that's emptiness. So I don't know. That's all I had to say.
Thank you for sharing. Charles.
I was just gonna say, so I like kind of try and put stuff into my own words when I'm like writing stuff down and listening to this stuff. And yeah, what I said was, the glass is not half full or half empty. It's totally empty, and there's no glass. And it's kind of funny, but that's all I got.
Thank you. You know, and we can talk a lot about it. We can talk and think about it and reflect on it, but you know, how many of us, honestly, if we were really sick or dying, could really view this body as empty? We could really view this body as, to use the original Buddhist terms, as not self. But that's essentially what we mean when we say that it is empty. Like, and there's another, in the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines. There's like Heart Sutra, you know, times 50, a bigger sutra. It says essentially that when the bodhisattva can really contemplate this teaching, really perceive this teaching, and not be scared, then they really, like, I don't know, they've really perceived. Tyler.
Was there someone in the Zendo that had something they wanted to add earlier on? Before I jump in, I just thought someone was in line already in the third Zendo. No.
Go ahead.
All right, cool. Yeah, I just, when we were talking about the cup, I don't know how much this relates or not, but I'm going to do my best. I've been reading recently a book, and they're talking about how, you know, this perception of the world existing before we're born. And we think of it as this, you know, we know history, and history came up, and then we're born, and then we live our life and we die, and then the world continues. And they're trying to explain it as you know, they said, you know, that's really not the case, is that when you die, the world as you know it is gone. It no longer continues in that way that you think it does. And this can feel really negative, but it really, for me, it sparked that idea of like, right, there's this stuff around me, but I've imbued all these things with meaning to me in my mind. And I've decided everyone else sees it the same and has, you know, or whatever, culturally there's some things, but then when I'm gone, that world doesn't carry on the way I'm thinking of, you know, everything that just keeps moving in that way. And for some reason that sparked to me, sort of like, right, like that's like everything around me I have put meaning into, I have attachment to or whatever, but that isn't what those things are. And when I'm gone, they will be what, you know, they will be gone because they're just what I have created them to be. And for some reason that was really good. Like it helped. I liked it. I forgot it was meaningful to me to kind of think of it that way.
It doesn't seem to make sense that the teaching of emptiness could be a consolation. But I'm thinking also of, so in Dogen's Genjo Koan, he's talking about death, right? And he's saying, you know, once a human being dies, they're not born again. But, you know, and he talks about, you know, firewood does not turn into ash, right? It doesn't like burn and turn into ash. It says the firewood has its own before and after, the ash has its own before and after. And it's like, when we're not imputing like an inherent existence, like there's firewood and poor firewood was destroyed. Like there was nothing that was firewood, which then is obliterated because now there's ash, right? There was firewood. It was a complete manifestation. Like it says something about its dharma position of firewood. And I find that like you're saying, the world is just an abstraction in our minds. We think of the world, we're thinking of a narrative and a picture and a view. And we imagine that thing is changing and existing and might not exist someday, right? When it's like, that is, that doesn't actually have any tangible reality to it, right? That's just our ideas, where the thing itself is not, it's not limited and graspable in that way. So I find that a consolation anyway. I mean, let's see, 1 minute left. Dennis.
Sorry, 1 minute to explain this to everybody?
You can do it.
So inanimate objects, the bell was a very great analogy. It has inherent meaning, like Tyler alluded to. It has huge symbolic meaning to us and everything. But I mean, if it falls out of your car and you back over it in the driveway, it's a flat piece of brass. So it doesn't have any inherent meaning as a bell. For us, though, you would have to totally eradicate any shred of ego to not have a self, to not realize a self. Is that a true statement? Is that, I
Like
mean,
you could realize the emptiness of that very ego. I mean, we never get rid of that, and we shouldn't, right? Because then we would like not be able to function. But at some point we can recognize that it is like that it is our imagination. I mean, we now what differs between us and these inanimate objects, which are much easier to imagine, be like, oh yeah, they don't have any, inherent self nature, because we have the added bit of not only mental formations but consciousness, right? So that seems like a special magical element that means we got that inherently existing self, right? Because we got this special consciousness. But that comes and goes as well. That changes, that is not graspable. And so there's really no a classic story that's meant to illustrate emptiness is the story of the cart. So I think it was it's not Nagarjuna, it's Nagasena. It's Nagasena is talking to King Milinda, and Milinda's like, I don't even know if they're using the term emptiness, but it's basically like, what do you mean empty? I mean, there's you say Nagarjuna is empty, but like there you are. And so Nagasena explains, well, you came here in a chariot, right? So is the chariot the wheels? Is the chariot the cab? Is the chariot the whatever you call it, the stick that goes to the oxen? Is it the oxen? Is it the whip? Is it the spokes? Is it what is it? No, each time the king says, no, that's not the cart. That's not the cart. But like, and if you took all those things and piled them up, would that be the cart? And yet somehow the cart, but you say, well, that then you're lying. How did you get here in a cart? It's like, well, the cart exists, but it has no, like, where is the cart? It's just something that manifests because all of these things came together in a particular way and are being used in a particular way. So I just picture, like, what if we're telling a children's story and all of a sudden that cart is like, oh, I'm Eddie the cart, and I hope that someday I can go to the city, and like, oh, I worry someday that I may be thrown on the scrap heap. Like that it suddenly has like a I'm a cart, and I'm worried about my cartness and all that. And like, to some extent, our little stories about ourselves are no more appropriate than that.
That's exactly the point I was going to make, so thank you.
Oh.
I was going to bring up the chariot story.
Oh, cool. Great minds think alike.
You should write that children's book, Domio.
But now I feel okay because I see there's no real cart nature in me. All the parts can come apart, and that'll be
It
fine.
end happily on the garbage heap or the part.
It's difficult to imagine how it should end. So it is 9:04, but Ruthann, did you have something?
I was going to say thank you for the talk, and I love the notion of emptiness, boundlessness, because I can say the don't know mind, because I have just this beingness, suchness. But I feel guilty about something today, judging someone, and I shouldn't have. It's like virologists say we leave a fingerprint. Boundlessness means I can toss off my guilt because that's my small self. So I'd rather stay in boundlessness after I apologize tomorrow.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
And thank you.
That just, you know, at some point, so next week we're talking about suchness, but then we're going to be talking about absolute and relative, right? Everything is empty and everything is relative. Like they are two aspects of reality and they are both equally real. All right. We offer the merit of this Sangha meaning to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna para.
Thank you, Danielle.
Hi, everyone.